and welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Muscoane. Today marks the 22nd anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was designed to protect the civil rights of people with a range of disabilities, but getting the law passed was just the beginning. The fight for accessibility, for services, and other rights has been slow and difficult, though much has been achieved. So this hour, we take a look at two battles, the one it took to get the law in place, and the ongoing one to fully realize its promises. Joining us is Cassie James Holdsworth. She is Director of Policy and National Advocacy for Liberty Resources, an organization run for and by people with disabilities. Cassie is an activist who has traveled across the country with her wheelchair to fight for equal access for the disabled. Cassie, welcome to Radio Times. And Maureen Devaney is the co-executive director and co-founder of Vision for Equality Incorporated. She has worked for many years as an advocate in the disability movement with the goal of helping to create a better service system for all. Maureen, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you.
So, Cassie, let's begin with you. Take us back to 1990 when the first President Bush signed the ADA into law. Tell us what that moment was like. Why was that such a victory, and what your expectations were for the new law?
Well, it was a dream come true. I mean, I remember when I was on my way to Washington to the signing, I was interviewed by the press, and I just couldn't really do anything but cry. I mean, for a while it was held up, and, you know, we were fighting for everybody. We didn't leave anybody out, and there were a lot of battles to get it passed. People actually chained themselves and they were in the Capitol in Washington in the rotunda, and they all went into a circle to try to push for that in March because it was being held up. And every day people were arrested, up to 100 people.
And were you in those groups?
Yes, I was. And we had the biggest march ever. I mean, everybody came out for that march to push it. And that was in March. And then it was passed in July, and it was a dream come true. Yeah. I mean, my expectation was the whole world was going to change, because before the Americans with Disabilities Act, you really had to persuade for access. It was a very slow process. There was little access. And, you know, we did see a lot of change in that area, but I just, before that, they could come into your house. They could do anything to you, put you in an institution just because you had a disability. Maybe a neighbor would report something. You know, you really, literally had no rights. You had to fight for education. You had to fight to go to college. You had to fight to get on the train. You know, Philadelphia has been fighting for the buses. And we are one city that actually the lawyers managed to have a lawsuit. So we were going to gradually have the buses even before the Americans with Disabilities Act, because Disabled in Action was out there on Broad Street blocking it for the buses. And that was a dream come true to see that everybody would eventually be able to have access to public transportation. And ADAPT was a huge part of that battle, and also of stopping the block, you know, and getting it moving to be passed.
Tell us about Justin Dart, because he was a central figure in getting ADA passed.
Justin was an incredible person. And, you know, I met him many times in Washington, but he came out one Christmas, I think it was in 94, to go to the Philadelphia nursing home with us to understand our battle around getting people out of institutions. So we spent Christmas at Philadelphia Nursing Home, and we took some of the residents out to eat at a Chinese restaurant. And he was one of the gentlest, most loving people. I mean, he remembered everybody's name, which I found incredible. At any conference, you know, he would mention everybody that was there.
And he was in a wheelchair himself.
He was the father of ADA.
Right?
Yeah, and he traveled this country, and he was very ill. And he was just such a committed person. I mean, and without him, I don't know, you know, if the ADA and the resources that he gave the community would have passed. I mean, he was truly the father of the Americans with Disabilities Act. But there were also Disabled People United. I mean, they really did, from every arena. And, you know, sometimes we're in our own little silos, but we all came together for that. And, you know, we need to come together again for some things.
Yeah. Maureen, certainly when we think about ADA, maybe the first thing that comes to mind for many people is physical access to buildings, to cars, et cetera. But there is also the services side, and there are also those who may not have a physical disability but might have a mental, emotional kind of disability. Tell us what ADA has meant for that population.
You know, we work primarily with people with intellectual disabilities, and the ADA has opened up access too, because many people with intellectual disabilities also have a physical disability or other disabilities that, you know, would really fall under the ADA laws. I think it opened up a whole area of civil rights for people with disabilities, not only, you know, barriers to buses and to, you know, curb cuts and to wider doors, but access to services. Before that time, but, you know, during the 80s, really, people with intellectual disabilities started, you know, really demanding community services versus institutional care. And I think the ADA and 10 years after that, the Olmsted decision really brought about people like my daughter who has an intellectual disability, the opportunity to do more in the community, to live in with their families. Oftentimes, years ago, when children with any type of disability were born, they were snatched from their parents' arms, placed into state institutions, and didn't even have the chance to live at home with their families. And that, and then after, like, the 1960s with President Kennedy, he developed a Commission on Disabilities, which still exists today, that it just evolved into the eventual closing of some of these larger institutions in the country. Today in Pennsylvania, we have 5 state institutions that house people with intellectual disabilities, and many of us in the advocacy community would like to see them closed. There's 1,100 people that live in those state institutions. Wow. Families of today, and I talk about families because it is a family unit that keeps our sons and daughters at home with us. We want community. We've had the right to, our children have the right, had the right to a free and appropriate education. Under the Public Law 94-142, which is now is called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, that every child in this country has the right to education in their public school and hopefully included in a regular classroom. A lot of our children aren't today. Yeah. So even prior to the ADA, these things were starting to happen. But right when the ADA came about, we've been pushing inclusion, integration in the community, and access to services in the community. If you talk to a family of or a mom of a new baby today, they want that child to be at home all their life. Yeah. We, who have older children, also want our kids to and young adults and adults to remain in the community. And when we, as parents, can no longer care for them, we really would like a community service available for them. And that's not always possible.
Yeah. So, Maureen, was the push for institutionalization, whether it's, you know, you're talking about physical disabilities or intellectual disabilities, was the rationale that let's have people who have these kinds of needs in a place where there are skilled professionals who can, you know, be there 24/7, help them, you know, with access, with all of the things they need? Was that the rationale for, and also, you know, that perhaps family members, it might be beyond the scope of what a family member could do to provide the kind of necessary services. So was that the rationale for having the institutional approach as opposed to the home care approach?
I'm not sure what the rationale was, but I do know that it became just the norm. That people were put into places because it was thought that families couldn't take care of children or adults with disabilities. However, there was really no community service system while these people were being placed in institutions. So as the community service system developed, there was the right to education for people to go to school. There was services through some of our providers in homes and in communities. And then there eventually was some in-home services that people could take advantage of. Mm. But it's still not enough. We still have a long way to go in that battle.
Yeah. Cassie?
I think, you know, part of the issue, like Maureen said, there was no services, but there also was a mandate. I believe it was President Johnson, that if you were on Medicaid, you had a right to an institution. But oftentimes, community-based services are still optional. And that's been the battle since we won the ADA. to, you know, get the Community Choice Act to, you know, so when somebody is eligible for a nursing home, they have a choice to choose community. Mm-hmm. And we have really seen a lot of changes as far as programs coming out and people being free. But presently, which we knew would happen, without that right to be in the community, we're always at risk in hard economic times to have it go backwards as mm-hmm. it is today. But oftentimes it's about the entitlement and the law. Unfortunately, you know, grandma was in everybody's home at one time, even in my lifetime, because I'm a little bit older. I remember grandma being in the kitchen. But with that entitlement and with two people having to work economically, mm-hmm. I believe a lot of these institutions became dumping grounds. And also, I mean, unfortunately, we became cash cows to fill beds. And there's still that battle to fill the beds versus giving people the dignity to live on their own. And it's actually cheaper to give people the right to live on their own, and often safer because, you know, they get involved with the community, friends, and it just changes their life. And I believe a lot of people have gone to work and contributed and paid taxes that, you know, without these programs,
so
would be just lying in a nursing home bed.
Yeah. Maureen?
Yeah, I'd like to repeat some of what Cassie said. There's an institutional bias. So today, if someone like my daughter or another child with a disability, if you couldn't take care of them at home, they could be placed in a state institution. So they have an entitlement to that state institution. So I could go tomorrow and say, this is where my daughter should live. This is not what we want. We want an entitlement to community services, to supports in our homes first. And then when we as family members no longer can take care of our loved ones, or if the person is significantly able to live on their own, that they can live on their own with supports, just like we do with our elderly families, parents and grandparents now. You know, if we can get in-home support from them, it's a lot more humane to live at home than to live in a nursing home. We're finding, and we have seen in our state in the past year and a half, 15 people went into state centers. This is unacceptable. We as parents and people themselves do not want that kind of service. And the reason that's happening is there's not sufficient funding for those folks.
We are talking about the 22nd anniversary of the passing of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and talking about what the promise of that law was, how much of it has been achieved, and how much work remains to be done. We'd love to hear your comments or questions for our guests. The number is 888-477-9499. We have much still to talk about, because certainly there are some issues that are right at the forefront right now in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, across the country for that matter. So we want to talk about that and much more when Radio Times comes back.
Abington Memorial Hospital supports WHYY and offers treatment for prostate cancer using the Calypso system. Miniature beacon transponders no larger than a grain of rice are implanted in the prostate, providing precise information on its location during radiation treatment. This procedure uses GPS technology for the body. Because radiation is delivered with accuracy, surrounding healthy tissue can be spared. 215-481-MALE to learn more. That's 215-481-MALE.
Teachers from grades 7 through 12 can take their classroom skills to the next digital level. WHYY, through American Graduate, is now offering scholarships for teachers to attend a special course, Visual Storytelling Basics for the Classroom, at WHYY's Hamilton Commons. Learn firsthand how smartphones, still cameras, and simple free editing software can enhance your classroom and encourage students. Classes are November 3rd. Apply for your full scholarship now at whyy.org/American Graduate.
Olympic athlete Tomua Anai isn't as well known as swimmer Michael Phelps, but when she's in the pool as a goalkeeper for the U.S. women's water polo team, all eyes are on her.
Goaling takes a lot of mental strength. I mean, you're either the hero or the zero. You either block the shot or you don't.
We continue our conversations with Olympic athletes next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Musk-Cohen. We are talking today about the 22nd anniversary of the passing of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA as it's come to be known, talking about the promise of that law and what remains to be done. We have two guests with us, both of them advocates for the disabled, who are telling us that there is indeed much work that remains to be done in spite of all the progress that has been made in the last 22 years. We've been talking with Cassie James Holdsworth. She is Director of Policy and National Advocacy for Liberty Resources. It is a cross-disability organization for disabled people and also run by disabled people. And Cassie has traveled in her wheelchair around the country over the last three decades, organizing on behalf of Equal Access, and she is also an organizer for ADAPT, which is a national disability rights group. We're talking as well with Maureen Devaney. She is the co-executive director and co-founder of Vision for Equality. Quality Inc. She is also the executive director of the Pennsylvania Waiting List Campaign, which we will be talking about momentarily. Ladies, welcome back to the program. We want to give the number again for our listeners if you'd like to join in our conversation. Perhaps you have got some stories to share. You've had some experiences. Maybe you have been part of the movement over the last 22 years to gain greater access and services for people with disabilities. The number is 888-477-9499. Ladies, when we left off, we were talking about what was known as community choice, but just the whole idea of having in-home care, allowing people with disabilities to remain in their communities, in their homes, in their neighborhoods, as opposed to automatically being institutionalized. So just to sort of wrap up that point, what is the status now? Where are we in terms of moving in that direction so that we're seeing more people able to remain in their communities as opposed to being in their institutions? Cassie?
I believe that we need more aggressive Olmstead enforcement, and that we need an Olmstead plan in Pennsylvania.
And when you say Olmstead, what does that mean?
In 1999, there was a law passed that we do have the right to community and services, as Maureen had said earlier. And but yet we still haven't aggressively enforced that. And we're moving in an opposite direction right now in this state. We did get in to the Health Care Reform Act, an option that states can choose that really has in it a lot of the elements that we need. But unfortunately, it's optional. Yeah. So we will continue the battle to free our people right now here in Philadelphia. We have fought hard to try to downsize Philadelphia Nursing Home or close it, and that's one of the battles that we still face.
And Maureen, you're not necessarily saying that all of these institutions need to go away in the sense that there are people who maybe don't have family, who don't have a community that would rally around them and be supportive of them. Maybe there are family members who are just not equipped to handle the needs. So it sounds like you're not necessarily saying that we need to get rid of these institutions completely.
Yes, we do need to get rid of the state institutions. The state institutions are archaic. I can say today people do get better care in them. For every person who lives in a state institution in Pennsylvania, we've served that same similar type person in the community. Okay. We have great providers in Pennsylvania who are willing to step to the plate to work with the person and their family to develop a program or services that are adequate for the person's need, or just support. Sometimes they don't even need a program. They need supports in their home. And once they can't live at home, that there are providers that can support them in their residential services, or a lot of times people can live in their own apartments if they're very capable with minimal support.
So the goal really is to get the providers to those communities and to people in their homes where they can give them better care perhaps than they would receive elsewhere.
Yeah, it's also a financial issue too. I mean, as much as most of us don't want a segregated setting for our family member or the person, it costs about $252,000 a year to live in one of these state centers. The average cost in the community could, if you live at home, could be minimal, you know, $10,000. If you lived in a group home, could be $100,000. If you lived on your own, it could be $20,000-$30,000, yeah, depending on what your need is. And when we were talking earlier, you know, the plans should be developed on the person's individual need, not on a cassette recipe of service. It should be what the person needs, not what is prescribed.
Yeah, not a one-size-fits-all kind of solution.
Exactly, because every person, you know, could need, you know, different supports. Some need minimal supports and some need, yeah, extensive supports, depending on their disability.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the more recent headlines that we've been reading with regard to ADA. One that's local is the taxi cab issue, Cassie, and where are we with that?
There was a case in New York that unfortunately ruled that the cabs did not have to become accessible under the Americans with Disabilities Act, but we're not going to stop battling, because remember, we had nothing. And we, at one time, didn't have the Americans with Disabilities Act. And regardless, we're going to continue to fight for cabs. Many states have cabs. In Philadelphia, I've been stranded at the airport. I get stranded more times when I come home, you know. We should have shuttles and, you know, accessible vehicles at hotels that can pick us up. And, you know, it's just been a real battle. And we're going to continue to fight until we have the cabs too, because there are emergencies that happen and can't get to a hospital, can't get somewhere with your child, and like everybody else, we need access to that instant transportation that sometimes door-to-door that is needed.
Is there is it a matter of retrofitting existing cabs or creating new vehicles that are equipped? What would it require?
I mean, sometimes it's cheaper to just get a vehicle that's accessible and they're out there. But some vehicles, like the checker-type cabs, could be easily accommodated. Yeah. So, I mean, it really doesn't, to me, matter how they do it, as long as they do it right. And, you know, disabled people have the ability to access a cab. And just because of a legal rule, we're not going to stop, because, you know, many cases for the buses we lost, you know, and then eventually we won. Mm. And I just say, you know, the disabled people out there, just don't give up hope. We have to continue the battle. We have a right to access like everybody else. Yeah.
I suspect, Cassie, there are those who would say it's not that no one wants to do that, but it's a cost issue. I know from what I've read, it can be something like $25,000 to $50,000 if you're, you know, starting with new vehicles. But what do you say when people say, oh, we'd love to do that, but it's enormously expensive to either retrofit all these cabs or to, you know, create new vehicles? How do you respond to that?
Well, I think it could be a gradual process. The Freedom Taxi has five vehicles right now. Of course, that's not going to meet the demand, but they're trying.
Is that
and they're
what's
doing
available?
The right thing, and they did it, you know, before anybody said they must. And I hope they, you know, I think they continue to gradually, you know, make that fleet bigger. Yeah. We're not suggesting that this happen in a day, but it just has to start to happen. Yeah.
How many cabs are we talking about right now?
Six.
In the entire city of Philadelphia?
Yes. I think there's one in Germantown. I'm not sure of the name of the company, and there's Freedom Taxi. Oh.
And the disabled population here is roughly what?
Oh, my God. It's huge. Yeah. I mean, I don't know the exact number. I'm sorry about that. I didn't really. But it's a huge population in Philadelphia.
Yeah, and those are the kinds of things that many people just take for granted. They don't even think about in terms of having that kind of access.
And as far as the cost, many states have already done this. I mean, you know, it's Philadelphia where I show up and get stranded. But many states have started cabs before anybody said they had to. Yeah. And, you know, there were good times. Yeah. And it would have been nice to gradually have that start happening.
Yeah. Maureen, one of the other headlines that we've heard and points of contention is Governor Corbett's decision to issue block grants when it comes to certain services for the disabled. Tell us about that and what that has meant for someone in your position.
Yes. We worked very strongly this year to prevent the block grants occurring. What came about with the government in Pennsylvania is that they're going to have pilot programs, and I believe 20 counties are going to have block grants, and they're going to test them to see how they work. The fear with the block grant, with the way they originally proposed it, was all the money that was discretionary money, basically, that the counties or the cities could use for people, was going to go into one lump pot and then be distributed as the city needed it, not necessarily as the money had been appropriated the year before. Mm-hmm. So it meant that people, say, with intellectual disabilities may not have gotten the funding that they needed. There's a lot of people who are not in our waivers and who rely on this base funding. And I know our county in Philadelphia, Kathy Sykes and Larry Pace, they rely on that money for people in emergencies. You know, that someone who may not be registered with the system comes out of the woodwork. They have a 90-year-old mother. They're 60 years old. They need support. Mm-hmm. There's no place for them to go. So they use that money that that they had in the past that would have come through block grants for emergencies, basically, and for other services also.
Well, let's go to the phones because lots of people would like to talk with both of you. We'll start off in Elkins Park and we'll bring Adele into our conversation. Hi, Adele.
Hello. I would just like to say to the women on the air that Disabled in Action, and thank you for mentioning that organization, Disabled in Action of New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania were also so active in suing the Urban Mass Transit Authority to have our buses kneel. And then we quickly realized since there were no curb cuts, it was impossible to get from one bus to the other. And so we had the Pennsylvania curb cut law enacted. And these two bills came before the ADA. Mm-hmm. There were many people who were working very hard to bring about changes for people with disabilities. Ed Roberts in San Francisco and Judy Heumann in New York. I mean, there were people working everywhere in the country. We sat in at Senator, his name just went out of my head, in Philadelphia.
Well, Adele, it sounds like, and I appreciate the point you're making. I want to give our guests an opportunity to respond to that. Just the work that it has taken and the successes that have been achieved in this battle with people banding together to make their voices heard.
We had a huge battle for the curb cuts, which we eventually won. But at one time, we had a mayor who said, you know, without the money, he wasn't going to do the curb cuts, even though we had the right under 504 and the Americans mm-hmm. with Disabilities Act. But Disabled in Action and many disabled groups fought. And, you know, they sat in at City Hall. They did whatever it took. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that same administration, it turned around. And as you can see, there's a lot of curb cuts out there. And it changed the world for disabled people. At one point, you were risking your life because you couldn't get on the curb. Mm-hmm. And there was a gentleman killed on Roosevelt Boulevard. And Disabled in Action went out there. And we marched and we surrounded City Hall. And we quickly saw a huge change. Yeah.
Well, anybody who's ever pulled a rollerboard suitcase knows the advantage of having that. And it seems like such a small thing, yet it has made such an enormous difference. Maria?
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to say about the Americans with Disabilities Act and the work that Cassie and her group did in Philadelphia for the curb cuts. It not only helps people with physical disabilities or other people who can't walk or whatever. It helps young moms with strollers. It helps the elderly. A lot of our elderly now, you see them out on the street, out and about because of the curb cuts, you know, helps the bikers. And so there's a benefit to society, too. And also, you know, with the cabs and the buses, it benefits other people. So it really is not just for one group. Yeah. It expands to the general community.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll go to Malvern next, and we'll welcome Dan to Radio Times. Hi, Dan.
Well, I follow this stuff because my wife's been in a wheelchair from a drunk driver accident in which she got a spinal cord injury 30 years ago. I have a concern that very little housing in private is visitable, plus there's very little rental housing available for people with physical disabilities, among other things. In Chester County, there may be 10 units available for rent in apartment communities. And new housing, private housing, is not even considered making it visitable with people in wheelchairs or just limited physical ability. I have experience with a gated community, retirement community that was built with all within the last 20 years, Hershey's Mill, 1,800 units. I know for a fact that there's only three units in that whole place that are accessible by wheelchair.
Yeah. Well, Dan, let me stop you there so our guests can respond to your concern, because certainly housing and accessibility has been high on the list. Cassie?
Yeah, I mean, there are huge battles in housing and affordable, accessible housing. We continue to fight nationally for that. We've been lucky in working in partnership with PHA to be able to get vouchers for people low income. But I myself have had the battle of trying to get a mortgage, trying to find a house that you could affordably make accessible. And it is. It's like a needle in a haystack. Yeah. I agree with him. There was just a big lawsuit around disabled people even getting mortgages. And luckily, I got in there. Yeah, and did some enforcement, and it should become, you know, it seems like it's being more aggressively enforced. But the visibility, we've been fighting for visibility in Philadelphia for a long time, and it looked like we were winning, and I think there is somebody planning to introduce a visibility law around affordable housing, but the huge battle is in private housing, you know, because if it's not visible, we can't, well, visibility is not just about finding a place to live. It's also about integration into a community, because if you can't get into anybody's house, they're bound to kind of ignore you, because they know that, you know, they can't invite you to the party, or you know, you're not going to be able to get in their house. Oftentimes I have to ask people to come to my house because I just can't handle their house. I'm getting older, I can't crawl up steps. So it's also about community integration, as well as about finding that needle in the haystack when you need a house.
Yeah. And again, these are the kinds of things that, you know, wouldn't even cross people's minds necessarily, but they've become huge issues in the disabled community.
Yeah, they are huge issues. And you know, and when you do want to invite someone to you know, your home and you have steps, it's a barrier for them. So, and I know Estelle Richmond, who was the former Secretary of Welfare, and she was also in Philadelphia for many years, and a good friend of ours, works in the health HUD, Housing and Urban Development, and I know she's interested in piloting some different projects now for housing, and you know, we want to try and work closely with her in the future, because it's an issue, and like I said, it's not just for us, but it's also for the general population as people age.
Well, it's obviously an issue that people are interested in, because we have lots of callers who want to talk with both of you, and we're going to return to the phones on the other side of the break. But we're talking about the 22nd anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act and what has been accomplished since then, but also what still needs to be accomplished, and how advocates for the disabled are continuing to fight that battle. Again, our number is 888-477-9499, and Radio Times will be back right after this.
He was an outsider. He challenged the art world by collecting the new masters and giving them a home. More Cézanne than the Louvre, and the world's largest collection of Renoir. Dr. Albert Barnes and his grand experiment in education, the Barnes Collection, the WHYY original production, proud to be part of the PBS Arts Summer Festival. The Barnes Collection, August 3rd at 9, on WHYY-TV. See a preview at whyy.org/barnes.
On the next Fresh Air, Christopher Bea talks about his new novel, What Happened to Sophie Wilder. It's in part about why some people have the capacity for faith and others do not. The character Sophie becomes a devout Catholic.
But that conversion doesn't necessarily lead to peace, doesn't end her struggle, but rather leads to a new struggle.
Join us this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann's claims that an aide to Hillary Clinton has relatives with ties to the Muslim Brotherhood and should be investigated is causing a split in the Republican Party. We'll dip in. Also, streaming the Olympics, what will we be able to watch on our TVs, computers, smartphones? That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY, and I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We are talking about the 22nd anniversary today of the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was passed into law by the first President Bush in 1990, and we're talking about the progress that has been made in those 22 years, but also the work that remains to be done. And to do that, we've got the help of two guests. Maureen Devaney is with us, and she is the co-executive director and also the co-founder of Vision for Equality, Inc. She's executive director of the Pennsylvania Waiting List Campaign as well. We'll talk about that in a moment. And Cassie James Holdsworth is with us as well. She's the director of policy and national advocacy for Liberty Resources, which is a cross-disability organization for disabled people. It's also run by disabled people. And Cassie has been across the country and back as an organizer for ADAPT, which is a national disability rights group. We have lots of calls for both of you, but before we get back to the phones, just wanted to ask if you would share with us a little bit about the work that each of you does. Maureen, we've been talking about the waiting list, talking about Vision for Equality. Tell us a little bit more about the work you do.
Yeah, Vision for Equality was started in 1996 by Audrey Cochia and myself as co-executive directors. And to monitor service for people who left an institution, a state institution called Emeryville. So we monitor the quality of the services in their community. And now we do, through our independent monitoring for quality, we monitor all the services in the city of Philadelphia, where people with intellectual disabilities live. We also have a training component that we train families and people with disabilities across the state on understanding the system and how to access services and what to do if they're not happy, you know, in the services or, you know, just information so that they have a better quality of life. And we provide advocacy, too, in Philadelphia for both education and adult advocacy if people need us. A lot of times we act as intermediaries, just another person there to support the family or the person to, get access the services or mediate an issue if that occurs. The Pennsylvania Waiting List Campaign that was started in 1998, and we're very proud of that that project also. This year, in Pennsylvania, there's about 15,000 people needing services, and about 3,500 of those folks are on the emergency list. And they are in very critical situations. Their moms and dads might be in their 80s and 90s, and they may be 50 or 60 years old with no services. Or they might have a mom or dad who isn't able to take care of them any longer because of physical needs or whatever. We also have 700 students, high school students, graduating each year from special education in the Commonwealth. And typically, the past 3 years, those folks have not gotten any services. Mm-hmm. So this year, we were instrumental with the legislature and the governor, and we were able to get services for 1,100 people. And all the 700 students graduating this year will get services.
Wow.
Now, it's a one-time only deal. Every year you have to go back to the legislature. And it was a very great success, and there's over 430 people in this Commonwealth who have parents over 60. So most of those folks hopefully will get services. The problem is we still have another 2,500 on a waiting list who need immediate care.
Yeah.
So while we were very thankful and grateful to the government for providing the supports, it still doesn't help everybody in need.
Cassie, I know you have been in the thick of things for a long time, and you could write a book about your adventures probably, but tell us really what is the central piece of the work that you're doing right now.
Well, I'm a policy director, and a lot of things I fight for are long-term care issues around deinstitutionalization and getting the services that we need in the community. Okay. I also work at a Center for Independent Living which in Philadelphia, which provides skills training, advocacy, information and referral, and their focus is also on deinstitutionalization. Unfortunately, now we have a waiting list. I believe it's over 1,600 people. Everything has pretty much slowed down. and it's a concern. Yeah. At one point, we felt that we were actually designing our own services, and a lot of them were becoming more consumer-directed, and we were moving forward with our lives like anybody else. But unfortunately, with combining things and changes in the system, there seems to be a watering down at that. And also, there's been rates cut for the providers. So providers are, some of them are going belly up. So it's hard to free people when they don't have the provider system that took us 30 years to build, and it's being kind of undone. It's a tough time right now, but we continue to fight.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the people that have services don't realize that people just like them might end up in a nursing home.
Yeah.
And people that could live cost-effectively in the community, it's going to be much more expensive in a nursing home. And even on the aggregate, like Maureen said, you could afford to care for the more expensive people if you got the people that shouldn't even be in nursing homes out, you know. And I think Ed Randall, our last governor, certainly showed that it can be done. He rebalanced, and many people are free because of it. Mm. And but unfortunately, we're moving away from rebalancing right now. I just wanted to mention, too, with the block grants, that one of the biggest fears is that that money won't go to people because of the flexibility. It could go to something else, even though, you know, it was intended to help people.
Might end up in very different places than where you might expect it to.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to the phones. We have lots of calls. We'll start off in Ardmore, and we'll welcome Myra to Radio Times. Hi, Myra.
Hi, how are you? I have a son who's now 42. He's the third of my children. And the one thing I want to speak to is he did stay home for some of his life, and now he's in a waiver program and has a day program, and that's wonderful. He's a loving, personable young man. But what also happens, and I don't regret being home with my children, or and I would do it again, but once my husband went on Social Security, and I knew I would then get his part of his Social Security, which together would be more than enough. And we stayed together, which is not, doesn't happen that often. But once he went on Social Security, what happened was they then took half of mine because he is allotted a certain amount for my son and myself. I urge somehow people to get involved in trying to fight that, because if your husband leaves and you think, well, I'm going to get part of his Social Security, you're then left in a situation with maybe your child or person is at home, but you're left with very little. And this is never told, or was never, the information was never shared with us. The good part about that is he will have Medicare and not Medicaid. And so that's for the rest of his life. He will have better medical coverage. And that's very, very important.
Well, but, Myra, I think you brought up an important point, and I want to give our guests an opportunity to talk about the issue that you've raised. Maureen?
Yeah, we found very often that it is hard for both parents to work when you have a child with a disability at home that you're caring for. And, you know, it's very difficult. You know, usually the mom can't, you know, plan for their future. And actually the whole family can't plan for their future because there's just so many uncertainties. Yeah. There's no guarantees in what's going to happen after the child is, or the young adult is 21. So, you know, that it's one of the barriers. You know, it's wonderful that we can have our children at home, but many times it causes an economic hardship on the family. So the services and supports that we could obtain through a waiver could really help us early on if the families could access early on. And one of the obstacles we have with families of children on waiting lists, once they're 21, and if both parents are working, oftentimes one of the parents will have to leave that job to stay home.
Yeah.
So it causes the economic impact on the family, loss of tax revenue, and it just goes in a vicious cycle.
Yeah. Well, let's go next to Philadelphia and welcome Carol to Radio Times. Hi, Carol.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to raise the issue of sort of the predictable but still sad, unfortunate, glaring absence of acknowledgement of deaf rights in America. Mm-hmm. There are 100 million deaf and hard of hearing people, and that doesn't include all of their extended families who, over 40-some years, including the 22 years since the signing of the ADA, have nearly 100% excluded the consciousness of the inaccessibility and lack of inclusion of deaf Americans. And the panel can speak to that, but I've been around WHYY all my life within two blocks physically, and I'll be 70 years old with deaf children now in their 40s, and we're an invisible mixed deaf hearing family. And if you want to talk about not being invited to a party, that's the national experience of anyone who's deaf in America. Mm. Obviously, that world cannot be listening to the phenomenal programs that I listen to daily on HYY, and I'm constantly hurt that the world of my children, their current generations and forward, can't experience these programs. So neither in the selection of the panel today or acknowledgement in the discussion.
Well, Carol, let me...
It is a purely hearing experience that's going on with the program today, and I wanted to raise that.
All right. Well, Carol, we so appreciate the concerns you've raised, and we're grateful for your listening to WHYY. Cassie, what do you say?
I agree with Carol totally, and luckily I work somewhere where we do outreach now to the deaf and have many deaf consumers, and many of our staff have learned to sign. Unfortunately, I went to a school, and I'm still trying to learn, but language is a difficult thing, but it's still not an excuse. I mean, more people have to be exposed to sign language at a young age where it's easy to pick up, and there has to be more inclusion. That is an underserved population, and I commend Carol for bringing it up.
Well, we'll stay in Philadelphia and welcome DJ to Radio Times. Hi, DJ.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me on there. I love the show.
Great.
I have a question for I have a question for Cash James Holdworth and Maureen Devaney. Since the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Commonwealth of PA has been a national leader in providing services and supports to people with disabilities in order for them to live successfully in the community. Does Pennsylvania remain a leader at this time?
Well, I will have Cassie answer that question for you. DJ, go ahead, Cassie.
I think we're moving down. I mean, I think we're becoming one of the worst states. I've seen a comparison, and we certainly have moved down from where we were at one point. We were actually a model to other states for consumer-controlled services. And I do think we're going in another direction, and a lot of our services have been eroded. Yeah. And I unfortunately continue to be eroded unless something changes and actually the state goes for the community first option.
Yeah. I want to talk about one of the bright spots, and that is this Saturday there's a very special event going on. Cassie, tell us about that. What's going to be going on Saturday and why it's so important?
At the National Constitution Center, there's going to be a Disability Pride Day, and there's loads of things going on to expose the public to disability rights and to honor Justin Dart. There's going to be an exhibit with the wheelchair he was in when he signed the Americans with Disabilities Act, and we certainly hope that it's well-intended and many people come. There's many people from the disability rights community, from all communities, to represent everybody, including the deaf. So, Carol, come out there. And we're looking forward to, telling the public about our silent history.
Yeah.
So.
And it's no accident that it's going to be at the Constitution Center.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we're very excited. And I think it's the first time the National Constitution Center has ever done something, that encompasses disability to this degree, and Maureen's been very involved.
Yeah, the Constitution Center's motto is freedom calling. Freedom is calling. And I think it's very appropriate in today's times that we're looking for freedom, freedom to live in home and communities, not institutions, and freedom to make choices and do what we want and have an everyday life like everyone else. And I think so it's very appropriate to have the celebration there. It's free to the public in honor of the ADA and Justin Dort's wheelchair being donated there. And we would hope the public comes out and meets us, because we will have representatives from every group in the city and the Commonwealth. And I think it's an exciting time. It's the first time that the disability community is really coming together to do something jointly. And we talked, you know, many times that we need to do this in the future, because it's in Pennsylvania especially, we have pockets of intellectual disability funding, and there's funding for people with physical disabilities. Other states have a disability unit that the funding would come through the one unit and, you know, distribute it to people who in need, depending on what their needs were. In our state, sometimes they pit us against each other. It's a shame, because you're, you know, needing services for one group and the other group needs similar services, and you're always like vying for a different pocket of money. So I think it's really, really going to be exciting. And I think one of the things that we need in Pennsylvania is some kind of long-term plan for all people with disabilities. We did have a long-term plan under Governor Ridge in intellectual disabilities. We had a plan to address the waiting list that wasn't implemented under Governor Rendell. So we would like to see this governor have a plan for all people, okay, so that they have a quality of life in their homes and communities.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being with us, Cassie James Holdsworth and Maureen Devaney. Thank you for helping us understand what some of the issues are, what are some of the battles that still need to be fought, while also celebrating 22 years of victories. If you'd like more information about the Saturday event, you can email disabilitypride@visionforequality.org. You've been listening to Radio Times, and I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane.